and big corporations to invest in human and environmental needs. The Tax Policy Center predicts the top 0.1% will see their after-tax income drop by 5.9%, while the poorest 20% will see their income rise by 4.4% in the last first year. The bill will also raise significant new revenue from corporations, including through a tax on stock buybacks. One noteworthy Build Back Better tax on the wealthy is a surtax on annual incomes above $10 million. Ultra-rich households will face an additional 5 percentage point tax on annual gross income, including investment earnings over $10 million, and an 8 percentage point surtax on income over $25 million. The first dollar of income over that $25 million, in other words, will face a 45% tax instead of the usual 37% top marginal income tax rate. Midstream.
Lebanon has always been a platform for freedom of expression and has always been a haven for the tormented, the oppressed, and the exiled. As soon as Lebanon is mentioned, its name is associated with all public liberties. Accordingly, Bahraini opposition activists found in Lebanon a few years ago a safe country for them after they had grown fed up with the practices of the Al-Khalifa regime, which is far away from humanity as can be. Bahraini activists sought refuge in a country full of human rights organizations and exercised their legitimate right to express their human rights cause. Back in their homeland, there are victims and prisoners of conscience who taste all kinds of regime torture without guilt or crime. Back in Bahrain, there is a regime that since 2011 has been practicing all forms of torment to suppress any political opposition. Fast forward to last week, members of the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society held a conference in Beirut that documented human rights violations in Bahrain. The conference did not appeal to the Al-Khalifa regime, so the Lebanese government was asked to take the necessary action. It is true that this is not the first time that this type of conference has been held on Lebanese soil, but the Persian Gulf state's insolence reached advanced levels after the incident of Lebanese minister George Qardahi. What was unfamiliar today has become normal on the basis that these tyrannical Arab regimes of the Persian Gulf view Lebanon as their backyard now. Paradoxically, the conference did not bring anything new or strange to the Bahraini regime. It did not come up with anything that human rights symposiums in Lebanon were not familiar with before. Perhaps the strangest thing lies in the Lebanese official reaction, which some have read as presenting credentials to Bahrain and Saudi Arabia behind it. Between Manama's objection and Beirut's response, which seemed more of a royal decree, two questions arise. What does the law say concerning the conference held by the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society? And how does the law view the reaction of the Lebanese government and its intention to deport Bahraini dissidents? It is crystal clear, my friends. The actions of the Lebanese government towards the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society are in violation of the Lebanese constitution and internal law, and are in violation of the rules of international custom and the charters of the United Nations, which prompted a lawsuit from a group of Lebanese lawyers who vowed to stop this illegal nonsense instigated by the Ministry of Interior. Yes, we are facing a serious incident in Lebanon that is not only related to the freedom of expression and state sovereignty, but also related to the official Lebanese response, which came as a political compliance to Bahrain's demands, mirroring the groveling of our Lebanese Prime Minister, who desperately wants the approval of Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. However, this is Lebanon, and this is unacceptable. It is forbidden to violate national sovereignty for the sake of saving face before tyrants. That will definitely lead to restriction of the freedom of activists and media professionals simply to please royal dictators who were not even elected in their own countries. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Lebanese Minister of Interior Bassam Maulawi requested in a letter he sent last week to the General Directorate of Public Security that all measures be taken to deport non-Lebanese members of the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society out of Lebanon. Well, please act surprised, but the Minister of Interior's decision came after a phone call he received from his Bahraini counterpart, Rashid bin Abdullah Al-Khalifa, in which they accused the Bahraini's Al-Khalifa regime, accused the Lebanese party of discussing this press conference held in Beirut as being unacceptable. Now, apparently, the Al-Khalifa regime in Bahrain were insulted by Al-Wifaq's human rights report published in Beirut, accusing Bahrain of arresting thousands of nationals arbitrarily, including hundreds of women and children, issuing hundreds of politicized sentences, and torturing hundreds of detainees. Now, can you see why the Bahraini tyrannical regime felt a bit, exposed? Well, to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Ali Al-Faiz, Bahraini human rights activist. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, the Bahraini regime considered the Beirut, or what happened in Beirut, as a press conference held by Al-Wifaq party as totally unacceptable, and is, quote, a flagrant violation of the principles of respect for the sovereignty of states and non-interference in their internal affairs, unquote. Well, I would take that as a joke, but let me ask you that question first. What's your take on this official Bahraini position, and do you think it will really affect the status of the Bahraini opposition group inside of Beirut?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for having me in your show. I believe there are certain points that should be clarified to answer your question. We in the opposition are prohibited from practicing our basic political rights in our homeland, Bahrain. The political leaders and thousands of activists are behind bars, and others are either politically persecuted in Bahrain or in exile. The second point is Al-Wifaq, which represent the majority of Bahrainis, more than 60% of the electoral vote, as per the regime numbers in the 2006 and 2010 election, were for Al-Wifaq. This political party is being resolved by the regime. The current authority, we believe, the current authority lack legal, political, and popular legitimacy. Bahraini regime will never be able to halt our activities nor to crush the opposition. And we believe our colleagues in Al-Wifaq society, the members of Al-Wifaq in Beirut, have worked within the law and exercised their rights in Beirut peacefully.
But Mr. Ali, why did the Bahraini regime feel insulted that Beirut gave a platform for exiled Bahrainis who simply just reported about the fact that Al-Khalifa imprisoned women, they imprisoned children, and they killed detainees for simply having an opinion, but could care less about the official UN reports by international human rights organizations that prove that all that was said in Beirut was actually facts. It was not something being told to maybe expose Al-Khalifa, because they were already exposed.
Well, the similar report has been issued by State Department, U.S. State Department, by the Foreign Ministry here in Britain, by the United Nations Human Rights Council, And 9 years or 10 years ago, it was also almost the same issues was represented by Bassouni report. We believe at this point of time, the Al-Khalifa regime understand well that political solution is imminent. There is a pressure to fulfill a human right obligation in Bahrain, and therefore they have to free the political prisoner and stop the human rights violations in Bahrain. And therefore, the Bahraini regime is utilizing any opportunity to wipe al-Wifaq and the opposition. This is the regime dream, to wipe al-Wifaq and the opposition, because at the time of the political solution, there will be nobody to have dialogue with or represent Bahraini project properly.
But look, it's no secret that all Bahraini activists who are part of the exiled people from Bahrain and others just fled the country to Beirut to find a safe haven for themselves and their families, where it's pretty safe for them in Lebanon, because they have an entire community that actually supports them and is ready to protect them. So since we know that no one really is going to get deported because it's against the law in Lebanon, then why is the Lebanese government putting this show on? For whom is it?
Well, we respect Lebanese, and we respect Lebanon law, and we believe we did not breach the law. We believe it is a political decision taken by the Interior Minister in Lebanon. And this political decision ordered by the Saudi and the Bahraini regime was a proxy only for this order.
But look, what makes me, as a Lebanese citizen, sure that no Bahraini will be deported, because basically it's against the Lebanese constitution, it's against our law to actually deport people who are taking refuge in Lebanon, who did not even violate our constitution or our law. And because it's a violation of the rules of international custom and the Charter of the United Nations, and Lebanon abides by these laws. So do you think Al-Khalifa might have a certain weapon that they might use to pressure the Lebanese government into probably trying to break their own law?
Well, I think it is Saudi mainly who play the game now. And this game, which is played by the Saudi mainly, is to escape their regional defeat and to fulfill United States and the Zionist goals. They are all, and certainly Bahraini regime, see al-Wifaq and the Bahraini opposition as an enemy for their project in the region, and in particular in Gulf. And that's why we believe taking such decision against al-Wifaq and the opposition is not only for domestic interest, but also for regional interest that related to United States, Zionist, and Saudi.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, Bahraini human rights activist, for joining us to talk about this matter. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Saudi Arabia's setbacks in Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, despite the attempt by the forces loyal to the Saudi Emirati coalition of aggression following the withdrawal of the militias backed by Abu Dhabi from the areas south of Hudaydah to to try and regain the grounds of the western coast and to achieve breakthroughs in oil-rich Ma'rib, the counterattack launched by the Sana'a forces dispersed all these mercenaries. Now, this sparked widespread condemnation among activists who are loyal to the coalition of aggression. They accused the latter of betraying its forces. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is running from one Western power to the other to buy more weapons to try to compensate their successive losses, unable to fathom that they have already completely lost Ma'rib. You see, Ansarullah's control of Ma'rib would not only remodel the balance of power on the ground, but will also put the long-awaited peace processes on the right track. Successive Saudi setbacks in Yemen in this following report.
For almost 7 years now, Saudi Arabia has been floundering in the sands of Yemen. It is not able to resolve the battle militarily in its favor and achieve its declared and hidden goals behind the war, and it has not yet succumbed to the will of the Yemeni people and to the forces that defend it in the face of the defeats and setbacks that it suffers daily. Rather, Saudi Arabia keeps swelling with obstinacy and arrogance. It continues to vent about its failures by trying to harm the Yemeni people through daily massacres and intense air raids. For months, the Yemeni armed forces and the popular committees have been talking about the liberation of Ma'rib, and they continue to make new progress daily without any ability on the part of Saudi Arabia and its allies to stop this progress. In light of what is happening in the entire region, and especially what is happening right now in Ma'rib, with approaching a complete control of the strategic region, and consequently the complete defeat of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and behind it the defeat of the Saudi project before the axis of the resistance in particular, it is just natural to expect an irrational Saudi bash using all available means. This was manifested in a continuation of Saudi arrogance towards anyone who disagrees with it, while Ma'rib city approaches full liberation in favor of the Yemeni army and the popular committees. It can be also seen in the Saudi hysterical pressure for a ceasefire, despite the increase in American armament to Saudi Arabia, which depleted its budget. With a change in the equations of the war, which Saudi Arabia believed needed just weeks to win, Riyadh sought to conclude a large number of arms deals in an attempt to achieve technical and armament superiority, which was already available, but perhaps to compensate for its vast failures. Statements issued by Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Britain, and America keep reining in, stressing the necessity of a ceasefire in Ma'rib, claiming that the quartet countries are committed to, quote, a comprehensive political solution to the conflict in Yemen, unquote, simply because they lost everything on the ground. Meanwhile, fierce battles continue between the Yemeni armed forces of the Sana'a government on the one hand and the forces of Hadi and the Islah party, backed by the planes of Saudi coalition of aggression on the outskirts of the city of Ma'rib. Yemeni armed forces even shot down a U.S. Scan Eagle spy drone while it was carrying out hostile actions in the airspace of Wadi Ubaida in Ma'rib. Local sources also reported that the Yemeni army and the popular committee secured the sprawling eastern Al-Balaq mountain range, while they continued to advance on the fronts south and east of the city of Ma'rib. The fast successive events in Yemen suggest that the liberation of Ma'rib will no doubt enhance the chances of a lasting strategic peace in Yemen, as it is the last stronghold of Saudi mercenaries in the oil-rich Yemeni governorate.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Ali, now almost 7 years now, the Saudi waged war against Yemen in order to restore what Riyadh calls legitimacy. It seems that the kingdom is experiencing some sort of a crisis related maybe to the futility of its procedures and its inability to come up with a radical solution to probably just shift the course of its aggression against the country. With all such resources, Mr. Ali, with all the state-of-the-art weaponry and war jets that can destroy cities in one round, basically, why did Saudi Arabia lose its war on Yemen?
Greetings to you. The main reason of Saudi Arabia losing its war on Yemen is the ignorance of the Saudi leadership to Yemeni society. Mohammed bin Salman, the current Saudi crown prince, when he began his war in 2015, believed that within 2 weeks he would be able to resolve this war in his favor, because in his belief this would facilitate the process of his ascension to power and being crowned king, and even transferring this so-called victory to other Arab arenas. But his ignorance of the nature of Yemeni society and the circumstances that historically helped Yemenis win their wars and defeat the invaders. This specific issue led to Saudi Arabia losing this war despite the presence of a huge arsenal of weapons imported mainly from the United States of America and European countries such as Britain, France, and Germany. But this huge arsenal failed to secure a military victory for Mohammed bin Salman. Because, of course, the Yemenis are the ones who are defending their cause, fighting their aggressors. Yemenis are known to be fierce when they fight. Historically, there are many invaders who tried to invade Yemen and failed miserably. Great imperial powers tried to invade and occupy Yemen but failed. Therefore, Saudi Arabia is added today to the list of countries defeated in Yemen who failed in invading and occupying Yemen. The arrogant personality of the Saudi crown prince who refused to surrender to the fait accompli is what led to the prolongation of the life of this aggression against Yemen. I believe that as long as there is a mentality in Riyadh that does not accept the fait accompli, this aggression will continue not only for 7 years, but for 8 to 10 years and maybe more. All developments indicate that Saudi Arabia's last stronghold in Yemen, which is Ma'rib, have practically fell under Yemeni fire.
Paradoxically to what you just said, Mr. Ali, we did see the pro-Saudi media reporting daily about progress and repelling ground advancements of the Yemeni resistance, especially in Ma'rib, which you just said that it has fallen, and about killing tens of hundreds of members of the Yemeni armed forces. But the facts on the ground, as you just said, and the path of the military progress there suggests that all of this actually is not happening. It's not the truth. How long do you think this situation could continue, knowing that Saudi Arabia itself is not in a position financially that could help it to continue the way it is right now?
Just to point out what the Saudi media broadcasts and the media of aggression funded by Saudi Arabia. It's clear that when there are victories for Sana'a on the battlefronts, there's a discourse that claims and publishes false news about killing thousands and targeting operations rooms and destroying control rooms. But all this turns out to be an attempt to moral compensation for the military defeat on the ground. For days, there has been information and news published by the Saudi media, which says that there are hundreds of deaths among the ranks of Ansarullah and the Yemeni army affiliated with Sana'a. But on the other side, there is ground information indicating that the announcement of control of Ma'rib is imminent and that a battle has been opened towards the Safir oil facility located to the east of Ma'rib. These facilities are crucial and Sana'a must reach them in order to secure the energy needed to generate electricity and thus run the industrial and agricultural production cycle. Thus, dropping the siege of fuel ships coming from the sea that are used as a weapon of war by the Saudi coalition. In practice, Saudi Arabia is losing, and therefore, it's trying to compensate by spreading false allegations. But for the sake of time, how long can Saudi Arabia continue in this approach and bury its head in the sand like an ostrich and claim that things are fine for it? With the passage of time, all the lies will be exposed. I mean, lying about such issues has a narrow scope. The truth soon became apparent, and the whole world now knows that Saudi Arabia was defeated in Yemen.
But Mr. Ali, yes, they have lost. Their media is lying, and at the same time, Riyadh is seeking to conclude more larger numbers of arms deals in an attempt to achieve technical and armament superiority, despite the fact that it's there, but it's not being maybe used in the right direction. But for example, for the Americans, Saudi Arabia is spending 74% of its military budget, for Britain 12%, for France 4% of that budget, and all that money could literally have built Saudi Arabia and Yemen and probably other countries in the Arabian Peninsula. Why is Mohammed bin Salman finding it so hard to acknowledge the power and capabilities of the Yemeni forces and just stop and start a dialogue?
When Mohammed bin Salman and his father came to power in 2015, there was a cash reserve of about $730 billion. Today's cash flow is about $400 billion. These official Saudi figures may be less than that, in fact. I mean, Mohammed bin Salman actually burned about $350 billion in this war, according to the numbers before us. The actual numbers may be more than that. Mohammed bin Salman insists on continuing with the policy of buying, using and employing weapons in Yemen, because he wants to prolong the life of this war, waiting for America to change its opinion on the issue of direct intervention, to bring its own military or its air force to get involved in Yemen in order to save Saudi Arabia. Unfortunately, he is still counting on this matter. The statements of the lobbying groups that Saudi Arabia employs in Washington indicates the same conclusion. Mohammed bin Salman tried to count on Washington adjusting its strategy on Yemen to help him by recruiting its military directly in order to win this war for him. Therefore, he insists on the policy of buying weapons in addition to another issue, which he considers as a means of rapprochement with the West by continuing to buy these arms. As for the returns on this money that Saudi Arabia spent on its war in Yemen, it was possible to achieve not one vision such as 2030 vision, but perhaps five visions like it, in the sense that this money was enough for Saudi citizens to live a life of luxury for generations to come. But Mohammed bin Salman chose to use this money in the war, thinking that he could achieve a military victory and be crowned as the militarily victorious king who wants to rule the region based on his Yemeni victory, according to his illusions.
Well, it seems that 2022 will be a very, very decisive year for Mohammed bin Salman and all his ruling party in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I want to thank you very much, Ms. Ali Murad, political commentator, for joining us to talk about this matter on the Mideast Stream. Now, thank you, and please stay tuned next week for the Mideast Stream. See you.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
If there is any wisdom left in Washington, the U.S. regime, which without the least doubt the leading purveyor of terrorism throughout the world, will stop its provocations not only against China or Russia, but against all other countries, including the Islamic Republic of Iran, which for the past 42 years has defied and defeated Uncle Sam's economic terrorism. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading U.S.'s Suicidal Bid Against China. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The United States is daydreaming if it thinks its provocative policies vis-a-vis China, including sanctions, increased support for Taiwan's secession from the mainland, militarization of the South China Sea, upgrading of hypersonic weapons, and the poisonous propaganda of the Western media horns will destroy Beijing's rapidly growing economy and military might and force it into submission to Washington. China, following the latest sanctions imposed by the U.S. on its industries, has made it clear that its retaliatory measures will make the American politicians pay a heavy price and force them to eat the humble pie. China has the natural resources, skilled manpower, technological edge, monetary reserves, political clout, and above all, the determination to defy and defeat the upstart U.S. Beijing has thus dismissed the sanctions on some 40 Chinese companies and said it is obvious the U.S. has reached the point of hysteria in view of the fact that its policies lack moral principles. Analysts believe that the U.S. meddling in East Asian region is bound to boomerang, since sooner or later Taiwan will have no choice but to be part of one single China. While Hong Kong, after the end of the British occupation in 1997, has long been absorbed into the People's Republic. As for the American militarization of the South China Sea, this provocative bid is opposed by both South Korea and Japan, which, though pro-US at present, know that their destiny is intertwined with China and not with an outside power that seeks to exploit them for its own nefarious goals. And this is the reason Washington has become desperate, and its Missile Defense Agency, MDA, has recently signed a contract with Stratolaunch to develop the Talon A hypersonic test vehicle to simulate Russian and Chinese hypersonic weapons. Hypersonic weapons are designed to defeat current missile defense systems by flying at 5 times the speed of sound and performing evasive maneuvers during their terminal phase. It is a technology in which the U.S. lags far behind China and Russia, and unable to match these two superpowers, has resorted to propaganda to fool the American people and deceive its clients around the world. This will not work, in view of the fact that an arms race, especially, is not to the benefit of anyone involved and only facilitates collective destruction. Thus, if there is any wisdom left in Washington, the U.S. regime, which without the least doubt the leading purveyor of terrorism throughout the world, will stop its provocations not only against China and Russia, but against all other countries, including the Islamic Republic of Iran, which for the past 42 years has defied and defeated Uncle Sam's economic terrorism.
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Iran is host to over 3.5 million refugees, under 1 million of which are documented Afghans and Iraqis. It is one of the longest, largest, and most protracted urban refugee situations the world has seen, given it started in 1979 with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Iraq's problem followed, but theirs majorly began with the American occupation of 2003. Although, since the 1990s, the common Iraqi man has been devastated by U.S.-imposed economic sanctions. The infant mortality rate in Iraq increased 150% from 1990 to 2005. For many an Afghan, a return home is a dream long lost. They see no choice but to risk their lives in crossing the border to get into Iran, braving treacherous borderland and tough mountain passes. The situation in Iraq isn't peachy either, but Iraqi numbers in Iran are negligible. Why are Iran's neighbors set in this direction, and what keeps them here? To see how some of their lives went this side of the border, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. For over 40 years, whatever peace of mind the Afghans may have found sporadically never lasted. They were attacked by America in 2001, and with the U.S. staying gone, the dust never settled. Finally, with the U.S. pullout this year, a Taliban takeover became complete in August, and 400,000 more Afghans have poured into Iran since. They tend to settle for unskilled, low-paid labor. But that's not every refugee or immigrant's life story. A one-hour drive led me to what turned out to be an inspiring case. Our trip en route to slushy suburbs south of Tehran didn't seem inspiring, so it came as a pleasant surprise when we found a wooden furniture factory bazaar on a slushy, wide dead end. With several mostly Afghan lads putting his furniture together, the bulk of goods does tell of a success story of one Mr. Yousefi.
I came to this country in 1994. I was in the construction business until around 2003. Then I started working for a company that specialized in this. That's how I got familiar with this job. It was around 2007 that we got a small workshop that was around 80 square meters where we provided various services. For example, we'd paint chairs for a fee. We continued the job and expanded the business to its current size.
I asked whether Iran had done him a greater service or whether he was contributing more to Iranian society.
I used to work in the construction business. We used to build street curbs and other physically demanding jobs at very low costs. This is a service in itself. As a foreign national, I may be forced to accept 800,000 tomans for a chair, but an Iranian colleague and neighbor of mine wouldn't accept a job at that amount. I'll take very slim profit margins to let the wheels spin. Our growth has been weaker compared to our Iranian counterparts, but we've worked hard for it. I started work at 8 a.m. and finish at 10 p.m. With such dedication, you'll eventually grow.
The self-fashioned entrepreneur showed me around his two workshops, one for carpentry and the other for finishing, as well as his exhibition warehouse. He uses all grades of wood but focuses on affordable raw material with a better finish. It's a modest income, he explains, in spite of the bulk of work and production, but he employs about 12 people at a time for what he called regular wages. I got to talk to one of the lads in his employ, his own nephew, Muhammad, born in Iran.
I studied the first 4 years of the elementary school in Iran. After that, I studied at a charity school in Shahrare for 3 more years. But then, because we weren't in a good financial situation, I had to drop school and started tailoring. We used to live in Varamin, but then my uncle offered me a job asking me to drop tailoring and go work for him and learned new skills in furniture making. I already know tailoring, so I grew very fast and became successful.
What brought his elders to Iran in the first place is an experience probably alien to Muhammad's generation. Although, given Iran's economic difficulties, the high rate of inflation and weakened rial and U.S. sanctions still ongoing, they do envisage an end to what comforts they may have acquired. Although Iran has been accommodating to those who managed to get in, even now that it's having to reverse its policy of looking the other way as people cross over into Iran.
When we came here, we knew that we'd had to work hard because we're in a foreign country and the Islamic Republic of Iran might at any moment decide to deport non-Afghan nationals, including Pakistanis, Indians, Arabs and Syrians. We knew we had to work hard so that if push came to shove, we'd have enough to live by for a while when we go back home.
Till today, since midsummer, every day 4,000 to 5,000 are making their way in from Afghanistan, negotiating dangerous routes for $500 to $600 per head with smugglers. That's a fee quadrupled since the situation back home has become scarier looking, and an economically suffering Iran is negotiating tighter border controls with the Taliban. Not everyone pays that much, but it's never a comfortable trip at times and car trunks into any city they can get to. Mr. Abedi is an expert on the matter. He joined us on Skype. Do listen in.
The most important opportunity Iran has provided for immigrants is their security. Unfortunately, security is a big regional issue, including in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. Three countries with the most immigrants to Iran, which have imposed a heavy economic burden on the country. They enjoy such security that they engage in economic activities. Afghans especially have a remarkable presence in Iran's economic activities. So do Iraqis.
Globally, nearly 5 million Afghans are displaced outside, 90% of whom are hosted by Iran and Pakistan. What's noticeable about Iran is that while 4% of refugees live in 20 settlements managed by the Interior Ministry's Bureau for Aliens and Foreign Immigrants Affairs, that's BAFIA, refugee populations are generally protracted here. That's to say, 96% of refugees live scattered among Iranians in cities, towns, and villages. What's also noteworthy is that children can now receive nationality even from an Iranian mother.
I love Afghanistan and I'd love to go see my country, but I have the same feeling for Iran because I was raised here and most of my friends are Iranians. I've grown to be like them, and when I'm around them, I feel like I belong here.
Going by government figures, in October 2020, there were 800,000 registered refugees living in Iran. 780,000 of them Afghan and 20,000 Iraqi. Additionally, nearly 600,000 Afghan passport holders live in this country. Refugees are given access to education, health, and livelihood opportunities. The idea is to help them thrive, not just survive.
The point is that granting citizenship can impose various costs on a country as a large number of people would be added to the population, which needs facilities, services, and budget, and might even create security concerns for the country. But all in all, the Iranian society has been accepting the migrants because we see most of the migrants as our brothers and sisters, including the Afghans and Iraqis.
Time for a success story of a different kind. That would be of a man who spent his early years in Iraq but came to Iran around 25 years ago to set up shop. You don't hear many frightful escape from home stories with the Iraqis, but if there are 5 million Afghan refugees outbound, there are over 9 million Iraqis displaced, if not abroad, at home. How things work out for them once they're across the border, Mr. Hariri will tell. We traveled a pretty distance on a foggy day to meet him at a successful big cosmetics factory.
As a national from neighboring Iraq and a Shia, I feel safe here and hope the ties between the two countries will strengthen every day. That's why I chose Iran for investment and expansion of my business. Thank God, I'm successful and have 120 Iranian workers covered by social security insurance.
The 2003 U.S. invasion displaced approximately 1 in 25 Iraqis from their homes. And fighting connected with Daesh or ISIS contributed to additional displacement. Yet Iraqis don't file into Iran as Afghans do. Mr. Hariri, Maher Hariri of Maher Arasam Makeup says,
I'm extending my residency every year despite a lot of problems that I'm facing. As an Iraqi national, I can't have a property in my name. My car isn't in my name because I don't have a bank account. My factory isn't in my name. The only thing I have going for me is that my wife is an Iranian. So everything has gone in her name. But most other immigrants aren't this lucky.
Quite a business. It's not always you get to see the process of production and enjoy seeing the finished product. I don't know about the cameraman, but I thoroughly enjoyed seeing my favorite products being made and finding them on display afterwards. Mr. Hariri seemed equally willing to help me choose hair dye colors or to show the team around his company from lab to warehouse. The company, factory rather, which has built over 5,500 square meters in two stories, has been passing with flying colors over past years, which means they can also export their wares. Our visit this year happened to coincide with a same-day visit by inspectors. Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
For the past 20 years, displacement has followed US and NATO wars in West Asia. But the West doesn't appear inclined to take responsibility. Western humanitarian bodies have called on their governments to step up, though. More on Western attitude toward the refugee situation in this region coming up. But that'll be after a quick media review to see what other news outlets have to say. For that, I give you Al Mohammed.
Welcome to another news section. I'm Mohammed Gord, and in this episode, we will be taking a look at foreign nationals in Iran and the country's decades of aiding immigrants and refugees. In Iran, thanks to the government's progressive and inclusive policies, refugees have been given access to educational, medical, and livelihoods opportunities, allowing them to thrive and not just survive. Now, Iran says it expects Europe to take responsibility towards refugees. According to Tehran Times, the Director General of Foreign Affairs and Immigrants of the Iranian Interior Ministry has said Tehran expects European countries and the international community in large, including the United Nations, to act responsibly in allocating the necessary fund and provide comprehensive support for Afghan refugees flooding into Iran. Mahmoudi said that Iran has been hosting and providing services to Afghan refugees for more than four decades. In a statement, the Interior Ministry official has said, Iran has been a major supporter of refugees and displaced persons, and despite economic difficulties and unfair sanctions, has provided valuable service to a large number of Afghan refugees and foreign immigrants without any discriminations in the areas of health, education, livelihood, vocational training, and employment. Stating that the government of Iran, unlike some countries, has not housed refugees in camps, Mahmoudi added, despite the little aid from international organizations, Iran has provided comfortable living conditions for the refugees nationwide. The Middle East and North Africa Financial Network has released a report titled South Korea Donates $2.5 million to Help Afghan Immigrants in Iran. According to the report, the Republic of Korea has donated $2.5 million to UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, UNICEF, and the UN Children's Agency to offer help and plans to aid Afghan immigrants in the Islamic Republic of Iran. On Wednesday, the ambassador of the Republic of Korea in Iran inked a deal of partnership regarding this matter with agents of both UN agencies, in attendance of the UN resident coordinator in Iran, Mr. Stefan Priestner. According to the report, the Korean ambassador has said that the Republic of Korea will remain as a staunch supporter of the UN and the host country of Iran in the spirit of burden sharing. With today's donation of $2.5 million, the Korean government's contribution for the last 7 years to address the Afghan refugee issue in Iran marks about $30 million. I sincerely hope that today's donation contributes to coping with the crisis and ameliorates the living standards of the newly arriving Afghans and the local people. Meanwhile, Priestner says UN agencies cooperate to support the Islamic Republic of Iran in the best way possible. We are grateful that the Republic of Korea is increasing the partnership with us by contributing generously to finding joint solutions to the crisis not only in Iran, but the entire region. Thanks for joining me in another news section. Now back to Leila.
The UN's refugee agency, UNHCR, continues to advocate for more third-country solutions for Afghan refugees. That's to resettle them, seeing the pressure host countries are under. Also, in Iran's case, its economic problems are no help to the refugee population it hosts either. Not if the current state of the economy persists, not in the long term. But for all its efforts, in 2020, UNHCR only received a resettlement quota for 120 refugees in Iran. That's been the lowest since the refugee agency started resettlement activities in this country in 1999.
Unfortunately, the Western European countries don't provide much assistance to Iran in its fight against drug trafficking. If anything, they take measures against Iran. We see the same attitude from the international community and bodies like the United Nations and the European Union with regard to immigrants in Iran. Their financial assistance might cover only 2-3% of all the funds Iran is spending. Iran has vaccinated many Afghan and Iraqi asylum seekers against COVID-19. Iran is providing them with facilities, including educational ones. But unfortunately, the aid Western and international organizations are paying Iran is a paltry sum.
Iraq's refugee crisis has impacted both Iraqis who fled and those left behind. Professionals such as engineers, artists, academics, and doctors were among the first to escape the war. And this stripped Iraq of many cultural institutions and frontline services when it needs them most. The World Health Organization, WHO, estimated that 70% of Iraqis lack access to clean water and 80% lack sanitation. That's conditions leading to cholera epidemics.
I believe most Iraqis have a sense of business, and wherever they go, they help build the place and do considerable work. That's why many Iraqis who've immigrated to other countries are successful. I know many who invested in Canada, Germany, and Dubai. Many also stayed in Iraq. As I mentioned earlier, I have strong feelings for Iran.
To put in more on how much Iran is doing for refugees, who prefer the term immigrant, by the way, given they have also contributed to Iran with the work they've put into building apartment blocks in Tehran, etc. Free primary health care, including vaccinations, essential medicines, and maternal and child health services, are available to all refugees, regardless of their documentation status. Refugees also have access to universal public health insurance to cover secondary and tertiary health care, on par with nationals. UNHCR reports that in 2021 it has been covering the insurance premium for up to 120,000 of the most vulnerable refugees. In Iran, refugee, undocumented, and foreign children study beside Iranian children, as primary schooling is allowed and free for all, even secondary education. Higher education is also accessible to Afghans and Iraqis, as in 2016, Iran's government scrapped refugee-specific fees. Iran may be calling on the international community for burden sharing, but actually it has taken refugee hosting in its stride. West Asia has an ancient history of war and peace, interaction and intermarriage between its lands, which now have modern borders drawn between them. Today, Iran and Afghanistan share, yes, a border of over 900 kilometers, and Iran and Iraq share a border of over 1,500 kilometers. That's a lot border-wise and means a greater inflow of asylum seekers.
Iran can create many problems for Europe and Western countries by opening up routes to the continent and using them as leverage to apply pressure on the West, just like what Turkey and some countries in Eastern Europe are doing. Iran can do the same, but the Islamic Republic isn't after taking advantage of migrants and refugees to put pressure on the West. I think Western countries should appreciate that.
In a meeting mid-December with the Hungarian foreign minister, Iran's president Raisi described Iran's assistance to Afghan refugees as a humanitarian and Islamic duty. He said, "We support Afghan refugees whether they want to stay in Iran or pass through Iran." But at the same time, he reminded Western countries of the many promises they made to help Afghan refugees but never fulfilled. He deplored, "The fruit of two decades of NATO and US presence in Afghanistan is murder, crime, bloodshed, and helplessness of the Afghan people. More than 30,000 Afghan children have been disabled as a result of the American presence in Afghanistan." Thing is, unlike Iran, Western states overall don't exactly respect refugees. Refugees may become residents in powerful Western countries and make it big, but they face a very different sort of attitude, one that can border on life-threatening situations.
Our country has provided refuge to at least 3.5 to 4 million refugees. That figure doesn't bear comparison with the number of refugees Western and European nations have admitted from Afghanistan. A country like Australia is accepting 50,000 refugees. Sweden and Norway are letting in way fewer than that. The number of Afghan refugees living in Iran is perhaps larger than all Afghans living in Europe. The burden to house the refugees has fallen on Iran and Pakistan.
According to a 2017 report, which still holds today, a report by the European Network Against Racism, that is, in the European Union, EU, migrants are increasingly facing racist violence and hate speech, as well as discriminatory policies and attitudes. Discriminatory policing is also a severe problem in the EU. And when policies and policing are discriminatory, it gives way to vigilante behavior against migrants and asylum seekers, who have minimal access to victim support services to begin with.
Iran has been better for us. The security we enjoy here is perhaps unparalleled in the world. If you don't commit a crime and live as Iranians do, nobody would bother you. It also depends on how hardworking you are. If I don't work that hard after I was given refuge, I could have been a sanitary worker right now. Iran is very safe. If you're working properly, there are good job opportunities here too.
Interestingly, even EU authorities and private companies commit hate crimes. These crimes include threats, intimidation, and killings. And what's being done about that? Of the 14 member states covered in a 2016 report by the FRA, only Finland, Germany, the Netherlands, and Greece monitor and collect data on hate crimes against asylum seekers and their accommodations. The FRA is the European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights. While talking of immigrants' contribution to Iran, incoming asylum seekers have been more of a weight on the government and system. The majority of Afghan immigrants being typically unskilled illegal workers expecting lower wages and agreeing to less agreeable working conditions, they have been a serious competition for unskilled Iranian workers. Between 1976 and 2006, Afghan immigrants reportedly led to an increase in unemployment in Iran, almost replacing unskilled Iranian workers. This is on top of desperation and culture-specific crimes they are known to have committed, which is yet another concern for the system. Mr. Abedi corrects me as per the nature of their job preferences or possibilities.
Some might say that Afghans are more involved in doing labor and jobs like that, but the reality is that Afghans are involved in dried fruits and nuts, and economic activities like import and exports. They are present in the construction and housing sectors. This is despite some legal issues with Afghans and banking problems, but they are still following these activities. They are doing economic activities in Iran, and some of them have accumulated great wealth and have been able to improve their financial status.
Plans are spread out, but when concerned, even culpable